This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Elizabeth Farnsworth about a book she's written called A Train Through Time, which has a kind of subtitle of A Life Real and Imagined. And it's a really interesting memoirish kind of meditative short book. And Elizabeth, I'm really glad to have you talking to me. Your career has been as a journalist. And is this kind of the first time you ventured outside of journalism into this kind of other kind of writing?
Yes. And thank you, David. I'm glad to be with you. Yes. I mean, I'm a longtime journalist, former correspondent for the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer on public television. And I'm also a filmmaker, and my films were all nonfiction. So this is the first time I've approached anything like this. And I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't had an experience which seemed to make it just inevitable. I never wanted to write about myself. As a journalist, you know, we are really not supposed to write about it. We don't focus on ourselves. If we did focus on ourselves, we would get in trouble at the NewsHour. Jim would always say, if our viewers remember you afterwards and not the subject of the interview, you failed. So for me to write a memoir was unusual. I'm glad I did it, but it was unusual.
Well, and I think you may not feel this way, but I feel certainly that memoir, writing about your own life, it's a kind of revelatory act and a risk of putting yourself into the world in a way that maybe other you just don't know how people will react to that.
It's true. It's very interesting how different it is to be reading from a memoir than to be traveling with a film that I've made. Really interesting. I actually like it very much. People start talking about their own lives. It's been very interesting reading at bookstores and other places.
Well, so you did kind of allude to an experience that prompted you to write this. How did that come about?
Well, I think I was exhausted. I was at Skywalker Ranch in Marin County, in the most gorgeous building you could imagine, really almost, it's just beautiful. Everything at Skywalker Ranch, it's George Lucas's ranch, is gorgeous. And the building is where Skywalker Sound has created the soundscapes of hundreds of films, including the Star Wars films. And I was there overseeing the audio mix of a documentary about the judge in Chile who first indicted him for murder. And it was a long process. We'd had a glitch in that we'd gotten the wrong specifications from public television for the sound mix, so we had to do it twice. And it just took a long time, and it was tiring. And of course, in a sound mix, you probably know this, you listen to the same line over and over and over as the mixer and the editor. They are trying to make it clear if it isn't clear. And in a documentary, you don't always have great sound if you're, for example, at an exhumation, which we often were, where the judge was bringing up bones to try to get evidence of murder. And after a long period of really mixing an exhumation, I left the room. I went into an atrium, and TikTok was there. TikTok is a character from the Oz books.
Right.
And this was the TikTok made for Walter Murch's film, The Road to Oz. And it's a film from the late 80s, I think. And at that moment, I pretty much put my arm around TikTok. I'm from Kansas, so the Oz books meant a lot to me as a child. I basically had this experience where myself as a child appeared to me and said, "What took you down this road this path of death and destruction?" Meaning, how'd you become a foreign correspondent in all these dangerous places? And, you know, I found it odd. I thought about it a lot. I reported it to a poet friend, Brenda Hillman, wonderful poet, good friend here in California. She said, "I think you ought to write about this." And I just started writing. She suggested that I write, I don't try to write from beginning to end, that I write, I let my memory bring up these fragments. After this appearance of myself as a child, I started remembering very specific things, both from my work and from my distant past in Topeka, Kansas. And that's what I wrote about, and that's what's in the book, those memories.
Right, and it felt, well, it's interesting you use the word exhumation, too, you know, because in effect, that's, the book is an exhumation of yourself.
It is. And it's a complete mystery to me why there are some memories and not others. I worked in lots of countries that aren't in the book. The first memory that came to me, and I'll never know why, was one of the first memories from my work in the book. This was the first memory that came to me that day, thinking about, after I thought about the experience of myself appearing as a child. And it was a memory from Cambodia. I've been to Cambodia a couple of times, and this was one particular memory, two particular memories, but pretty much the same time. Who knows? I mean, memory is, I love it. It's very closely tied to imagination, and it's mysterious and wonderful and revelatory.
Mm. Well, and in fact, I think that, you know, it's kind of an integrative process that you went through in this story,
I think. I should say that the one book I always wanted to write was a book about the experience of losing a mother, not so much from my own point of view. I actually did, part of my book is about losing a mother. We're revealing this now, but it's pretty much revealed soon in the book. But I wanted to write a book interviewing a lot of other people, and I did a lot of research about it. And about the time I finished the research, Hope Erdman's book, is that her name? I may have her name not quite right. But anyway, it's called Motherless Daughters, came out. And it was a very good book, I thought. It really did just what I wanted to do and confirmed my experiences that they weren't odd at all. And so I didn't mind writing about, and it was, of course, it was integrative and important for me, I think, to go back and write about some of those experiences as a child losing a mother. I hope they've been useful for people, and I find they are. Lots of people want to talk to me about it. I get letters, beautiful letters from people talking about their own experiences.
Yeah, I felt that. I mean, obviously, well, at least for me, it's not an experience I directly had, but my wife lost her mother early in her life, so I felt like I've experienced some of that through her, and I thought that it was very... I think it's something that a lot of people do experience, the loss of a parent. And it's, I suspect that there are unresolved emotions and feelings that that get buried, and that the exhumation process, you know, the talking about it and the kind of exploring what the things mean is actually really a bit, even if it's somebody else's story, can be really good.
I think so. I agree with that. And I think we have a lot in common. I find that in particular, people who lost mothers before about the age of 10, I have a lot in common with them.
So in this book, the kind of, I think the narrative structure kind of revolves around the train trip to from Topeka to California. You say that some of the things aren't true and some are not true. And I don't want to reveal things to, you know, readers that might, it might spoil things for them to know too much about the book. But your father worked for the railroad in Topeka.
My father didn't, but my grandfather did. Many members of our family did. We were a railroad family.
So was it, and when you did this trip, this was mid-early 50s, like 1953?
Yes, my father and I actually did take a trip after this tragedy in our family. He decided that we would go on the Union Pacific rather than the Santa Fe, which is the railroad for whom my family worked. But he had in particular been many times on the Santa Fe places, but he wanted to go on the Union Pacific to take the northern route to California. And I think he was partly influenced by reading about the great blizzards in the Sierra Nevada and that sometimes the train might get stuck there. And we took that train. And the book, the through line, the narrative line of the book is that train trip and the things that happen, and also flashing back or flashing back and forward from the train trip to younger events in my life, and then my life as a journalist. I was clearly, I mean, my brain was clearly trying to present me with images that would explain how I had gone from being from this railroad family in Topeka, Kansas, to being in very difficult journalistic. I wasn't a war correspondent, but I was in a lot of rough places working over the years. And that's clearly what I was trying to figure out.
You mean trying to figure out how?
What was the relationship between my past and my, especially my childhood, and becoming this world traveler in these dangerous places? And the train trip is really, it's a train through time. That's what the book is about.
Right.
And I go into different times from that train. And things happen on the train. A few things happen that are wondrous, almost magical, and thank you for not revealing them. But I do reveal them at the end. I decided, and Jim Lehrer advised this too, that as a journalist, it was fine to use fiction off and on, but that I had to be quite clear what was fiction and what wasn't. And all of the parts of the book that are about my work are carefully fact-checked and nonfiction. But the parts about my childhood and some small parts about my childhood and some small parts about the train aren't true.
Well, and I think that there's something accurate about that in the way you think about one's own memories as a child.
Yes,
there is,
I agree with that.
So much that is kind of, we make memories as well as, you know, reliving experiences, but we reshape those experiences too.
Yes, we all know that if I have four siblings, if we all sit at, we've all sat at the same dinner table, and we have very different memories of it. It's amazing how memory and imagination are linked.
No, that
just
is true.
Amazing to me. And I also think that imagination throws itself up when you need it. And clearly, I mean, I'm functioning poetically in some ways here, using images to describe something that I still have no words to describe. And that's another role of imagination that I'm so grateful for.
Right. Well, it's a coping mechanism. And I think that applies also not just to your, you know, to the difficulty of losing your mother when you were young, but also a lot of the journalistic experiences are about loss and,
yes,
and suffering. Maybe sometimes you're not your own directly, but people near you and close to you, figures in the world that you get to, that you are part of because you're reporting on their stories.
Yes, that's right. Many of the people that I worked with who went further than I did and were war correspondents or more, I knew better cameramen and sound men who worked in war, you know, they get PTSD. And, I don't think I did, but I certainly had experiences that did lead to this combination of memory and imagination that was both helpful, sometimes hard, but helpful too.
Do you feel that, and I think it's right also to explain to the reader afterwards.
I'm glad you think that. I'm so glad I did.
Well, I think one reason it's important is because there are occasions well known now, I think, in certain memoirs where the author created stories that were not true, but were purported to be true. And,
yes,
and I think it's important to separate or distinguish imagination as a form of creativity from imagination as a form of falsehood.
I agree. I really do. I think that's a wonderful way to put it, David. I agree with that. And I'm so glad that it was wonderful in a way, the way Jim Lehrer handled it, because, you know, he's such a great journalist and he's been a wonderful mentor to me. But when he read the book, he's written many, many novels. I think Jim's written 25 novels, something like that. So he loves fiction, and he believes that fiction is sometimes truer than fact.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, I don't care how true it is when you're imagining it, you really must let us know what's true and what isn't. And I don't make a big deal of it, as you could see in the book. I don't think I needed to belabor it, but it's pretty clear. And some people don't know when I'm starting to be wondrous,
right,
and know right away. It's interesting.
Right. No, I will confess, when I read the book, I had no idea. None.
Do you know that I didn't want any of it to happen. It just happened. The part where my imagination took over. In a way, I just loved the process of it.
Well, it was beautiful.
Thing about the train that will explain it. I see the train tracks where we were on one train that went to Cheyenne called the Portland Rose, and then we were on a very, very famous streamliner called the City of San Francisco, which was one of the great trains. And we got on it in Cheyenne, and then we went to, you end up in Oakland. You have to then take a ferry to San Francisco. But I go that way a lot because Highway 80 goes from where I live in California, right, to the San Francisco Bay Area. And so I would be looking at those tracks, and I knew that a train had gotten stranded on those tracks in a blizzard, which we can reveal is something that happens in the book. And I just started thinking. First, I imagined a film about it. And then as part of writing this book and really having been on that train, I started thinking a whole lot about what happened to us on the train and what might have happened to us on
right.
the train.
Right.
So it was really a wonderful process for me. It was interesting.
Well, and of course, you know, trains, at least for a period of time, trains were were very important for storytelling in Hollywood movies. You know, they're great train stories and, you know, things happening on a train because you're in this enclosed space and you're with characters that, you know, you are with over time. So the train as a setting, I think, is one that's familiar if one has seen a lot of, you know, kind of the great Hollywood movies of the 40s and 50s.
Yes, yes. And I have seen a lot of them, and I love them. So I agree with that. And trains, I mean, some people say that even jazz has been affected by the clickety-clack of a train. Trains in this country are, you know, almost mythical in some ways.
Yes.
They did
yeah.
terrible damage as they were built across the country, and Native Americans were killed, and everything that we know that happened. And they also did amazingly wonderful things as they were built across the country and made goods available cheaper and better medical care, et cetera, et cetera. So their trains have a lot. They have so many aspects to them that we writers might like.
Well, in fact, I agree with everything you just said. And then there is the fact that we have time zones is strictly because of trains. Because
yes,
they had to create schedules that people would follow, and there was no such thing as a Pacific time zone or a Rocky Mountain time zone before the trains.
That's right, and I'm actually fascinated by timetables and time zones and what it means to be in a different time zone. I like time travel books. Time travel movies.
Oh, yeah.
So it was sort of a natural for me, I think.
Oh, well, that's true. You know, I hadn't thought of that this is a time travel book in a lot of ways. Yeah. Well, I sort of read it as, you know, the back and forth between present or near present and your youthful personhood was very... there's a word. It was kind of very contiguous. It didn't feel like I was literally traveling, but I, you know, I felt like that your back and forth made sense.
Oh, I'm so glad. I'm so glad.
Well, so of the places, you know, because I also wanted to talk a little bit about Dorothy and Oz because that plays such a big role, but it's also because you used Return to Oz, which is not the famous Oz film, but it seems like the whole Oz story is also one of using imagination to reconcile daily life.
Yes.
So in a way, it's a
and
perfect...
And especially to reconcile a little girl who's lost her parents,
yes.
who's an orphan. And her... You know, all of us, anybody that's listening also who read books about young, plucky girls and boys when they grew up, we're all influenced by them. And she certainly influenced me. And for a Kansan, the Oz books were, I think I have a bunch of them, and I bet I read, you know, half of them. So it was very influential. And TikTok was a character I recognized. I knew that was TikTok in the atrium of they call it the technical building at Skywalker Ranch. I walked by him every day when I was going to the mix. but it just didn't really hit me until one minute. Why am I not writing that kind of book, or why am I not more carefree the way that I was when I read those books?
Mm.
Why am I up here dealing with exhumations and the dumping of bodies from helicopters into the sea? Which one of the scenes in our film is bringing up the rails that bodies were tied to and brought up from under the sea in Quintero Bay in Chile. I've spent a lot of time in Chile. And so that was the way I was thinking.
That in the documentary you did about Chile was about the judge who, much later, you know, after Pinochet had been out of power,
yes,
for a period,
yes,
of time, but Pinochet...
In the late 90s and early 2000, like, I think he was appointed in about like 98, and then up until about 2008, he was in 2005, he was investigating, 2004. And he had been pro-Pinochet, so it's a very important story. He'd been, pro-Pinochet is not quite the right word. His family was very conservative in the sort of traditional sense, and with ties to the Chilean military, which had not been the kind of military that intervened in Chilean politics very often. And so he did not, his family did not support Allende. His father was a diplomat and a famous poet in Chile. But he was appointed sort of by lottery. His name was at the top of the list when it came time for this very important investigation of Pinochet's crimes. And in Chile, in that period, judges investigated and tried crimes, criminals. And so we got to follow him, and we followed him for several years as he was investigating, and he changes completely in the process of the investigation.
Yeah, I've wanted to see that documentary, and I for some reason never have.
I had worked in Chile when Allende. I worked there during the campaign. I made helped in a very minor way. I was quite young. Make a film during the campaign, a feature film, and so I had friends who were killed once Pinochet took power when he overthrew Allende. And, I mean, the American Charlie Horman, who is the subject of the film Missing, for example, is somebody that I knew. So this is something that's affected me deeply for many, many years, the experience of a U.S. involvement in a dictatorship in Chile.
Right. Well, and you also write about the U.S. involvement in Vietnam.
Yes.
And the return,
yes,
of... I love that story of the young man who returns to... Vietnam to find his family.
Yes, yes. I was lucky to meet somebody who had been airlifted out of Vietnam when pretty much his whole family was killed by American soldiers. The same soldier saved him, and we went back with him when he got married in a very small village south of Da Nang. You had to hike into the village. It was an I went back to that village more recently, and it has been an amazing experience to know that village and to know him. His name is Pham Thanh.
Yeah, I thought that was very powerful because, well, all of the things that happened to him and to his family, and, you know, and just how that has become reconciled. As much,
yes,
as it is possible to do in the, you know, over time, but people do have that great resilience to figure out.
And I agree with that. I think it's surprising how resilient people are. I suppose one of the reasons I wanted to do what I did is because if people who suffered so greatly, losing a parent is nothing compared to the things that happened to some people. They're so resilient. It was always an inspiration to me, really.
Yeah, no, I think that was, that is sort of the theme of the book is resiliency and reconciliation, you reconciling with yourself in some ways.
In some ways, although I'm not a Pollyanna, I also think that, it's pretty clear in the book that for some things there's no word that can cover the horror that happens to some people. And I'm not a Pollyanna about what their lives are afterwards, but many people are amazingly resilient.
Yeah, well, that is, we somehow people figure out how to make it work. Although it would be foolish to say that everyone does, because we know that horrors of war,
damning, permanent.
Yeah, and for a lot of people, there is no reconciliation.
Yeah, I never use the word closure or anything like that. I just think we learn to live with certain things.
But some people actually don't. They carry that pain
forever. Well, part of learning to live with it is sometimes they don't and they carry it and they're miserable, but they're persisting in some way.
Yeah. Although I do feel, and maybe this is off topic, but I feel like those sufferings can last for generations because they're passed on from parent to child in direct or indirect ways.
Yes. Well, we know now that actually they are passed on directly. Trauma is apparently, from the new research I'm seeing, passed on from parent to child. It can be.
Right.
There are very interesting books about this now and studies about it.
Right. Well, it helps. I mean, and I think we kind of know this, even though we might not have had the scientific evidence for it until recently, but we can see it in the way that people's lives are shaped who are the children of trauma or the grandchildren of trauma.
Yes.
You know, it just goes on and on. And you can even see it in the, you know, sometimes the way wars occur because they're generations later from some horrible event and the people are still carrying it around with them.
Yes. Think of the Civil War here.
Yes, I know. Still alive. And it's 150 years later. There are, it absolutely is still an ongoing part of not everyone's lives, but certainly
all lots. The wonderful elements of life are maybe passed on too. We can hope that.
Well, we do hope
lots
that.
Lots of good things that happen we're still thinking about too.
Right. Well, art and love and, you know,
that's
all
right.
The good stuff that,
right.
Yeah, that helps to offset some of the suffering that occurs. Well, I did want to say I really enjoyed this book. I thought your writing was extremely lucid and kind of just carried me along. I thought it was really a beautifully written book.
Thank you, David. It means a lot to me that you think that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You know, it's a book that I really felt powerful, but it changed me. It helped make me feel something that I had not recognized before. So I appreciate that.
Oh, well, I appreciate your wanting to talk to me about it.
Well, thank you. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. I've been talking to Elizabeth Farnsworth about a book she's written called A Train Through Time, A Life Real and Imagined. And I should mention, there are these really amazing pieces of photo art by someone named Mark Sur that illustrate the book in just kind of beautiful dream state ways. I did want to mention that. They're really great. So thank you, Elizabeth.